Basically, what I want to share in this session is one basic concept of what Christianity is, and then two ways we fall away from it. Okay, so really kind of simple in a sense, but I think this could be really helpful. I hope it's going to be helpful in terms of how we live the Christian life, how we view it, how we help others live the Christian life, how we spot when something isn't quite right. Do you ever get that experience where you visit a church or go to a session at a conference like this, or you know, you go to something and you think, something's a bit not quite right, but I don't know what it is. Maybe even this session could be helpful with that. Not to make us, you know, ready to fight, but just to help us be discerning, just to spot when something isn't quite, you know. It's nice when you first become a Christian, you discover this whole world of Christianity. All the books and the radio stations and the TV shows. And you, oh, wow, there's so much stuff in the Christian world. Isn't this like heaven? And then after a while, you realize some of it is not so heavenly or so helpful. Just because it's been published, that doesn't mean it's right. So hopefully this session can be a little bit helpful for us. So here's the really simple kind of introductory concept. Where are you looking? Okay, that's foundationally important. Where are you looking? And I'm not really referring to the eyes in your head. I'm really referring to the eyes on your heart, right? That core of who we are, the thing that drives us, that we respond with, however you want to define heart, the heart looks to something. Okay, in Ephesians, it talks about having the eyes of your hearts enlightened. That's what I'm referring to, is the very core of who we are. What are we looking at? Let me just show you a couple of places. These are going to be familiar, I'm sure. But John 3, for example, when Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, he basically takes about 8 verses to tell Nicodemus that he's dead, spiritually speaking. And then Nicodemus says, how then can I not be? You know, like, you're melting my mind and my mental circuits and my theological categories. And Jesus is saying to him, you know, you are spiritually dead. And Nicodemus assumes that he's kind of very successfully alive. But then when Jesus starts to explain to him how he can have life, you remember how he says to him down in verse 14, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. Remember that? So he takes him back to Numbers, yeah, Numbers 21, that incident where they were out in the wilderness and they were in trouble. They managed to put their campsite on top of a nest of snakes and they were just getting bitten and dying. Tends to ruin the day, I find. That's why I live in England. We don't do snakes. That's much better, I think. But for them, they were in the wilderness and, oh no, I've been bitten by a snake. The clock is ticking and I'm going to die. That's how it works, right? And so what did Jesus say? Remember that? Remember what was going on? And what happened? They went to Moses. Hey, Moses, we're dying. And Moses went to God and said, God, we're dying. And God said, I want you to take a snake and I want you to put it up on a pole. Not a snake, but a metal one. Right? Is it brass snake or bronze snake? Up on a pole. And the image there is not like the happy snake you have outside a pharmacy, right? That's kind of sneaking out from behind a stick. It's a snake that's been skewered, right? Spear through the head, and then it's wrapped around as it's dying. It's a dead snake. And God tells Moses to put that dead metal snake up in the camp. And then what was the instruction? Do you remember? What were you supposed to do? Look at it. Yeah? Look and live. If you look at the snake, you will live. And so when you're doing your morning stretch in the wilderness and you put your hand on the tent pole and then you see the two holes in your hand, what do? You look and live. If you do anything else or try anything else, you're going to die. If you start checking Google, if you call an ambulance, if you call for a nurse, if you start tying a belt around your arm, anything else, you're going to die. But if you trust what God has provided, then you immediately fix your gaze on the serpent, the image of the dead snake, right? That God's going to crush its head. It's a very Genesis 3 kind of image, right? You look and then you live. And what happens when someone comes up and says, hey, we're going to play football, or hey, we're going to work, or hey, we need to, can you help with this? Sorry, I'm looking. Oh, you've been bitten. Okay, fine. You know, it's breakfast time. When do I stop looking? Because, you know, I'd like to eat, but I'm looking. It was a really kind of simple instruction. You know, if you're bitten by the snake, you look and you live. That was a story in Numbers. But here, Jesus tells Nicodemus that, right? He says, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so in the same way must the Son of Man be lifted up. And then he explains that whoever believes in him may have eternal life. So what does it mean to believe in Jesus? The same thing it meant to believe in the snake in the wilderness, right? And that's kind of our story, isn't it? You're living your life. Things aren't going great. You eventually discover that you're dying. Then you're offered life if you will trust in the one who was lifted up from the earth. And so the cross is presented to you in a sermon, or you read about it or whatever. And then your heart goes, ah, that's my only hope, right? You look to Jesus. What's the Christian life? That. Like, what defines you, Jesus? Oh, yeah, fine, but what are you thinking about, Jesus? So how's your week going to progress? I don't know, but I'm kind of focused on Jesus. Like, that's what we're supposed to be, right? It's a very simple eyes on Jesus to live the Christian life. That's how we get in. That's how we get on as well, how we grow up. And we get all sophisticated and we get, you know, getting clever, going to ELF, learning big words. It doesn't really move beyond that. If you think your Christianity used to be about Jesus, but now, you know, it's about theology, it's about practice, it's about this, it's about that, that's kind of dangerous, right? Because it's really looking to the one that God has provided. And so, of course, it doesn't mean that we stare into space, but our hearts kind of do, you know? In every decision, in every situation, in every challenge, in every tough time that we go through, our hearts are... Jesus, I need you. I'm looking to you. Would you guide me through this? Carry me through this? What do you want me to do today? What next? How do I answer this question? How do I help this person? There's a kind of all for Jesus sense to Christianity. Now, that's not just John 3, is it? Okay, let's just take another couple of examples. Anyone remember 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18? This is kind of the, I suppose, the ultimate verse about how we grow as Christians. Paul says, we all with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. How do we grow? Beholding the glory of the Lord, looking at him. Okay, or how about Galatians? Can't resist a little bit of Galatians. It's a good book, as I mentioned already. Galatians 2:20. This is kind of right at the end, the main idea of the book. Paul says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. That little phrase, I live by faith. What does that mean? I'm looking to him. He's the one that I'm devoted to. He's the one that I'm trusting. He's my hope. But then, start of chapter 3, I always feel nervous reading these verses because they're a little bit like a hand grenade that you kind of roll into a group of Christians and people get upset. But he says, O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Who has cast a spell on you? And then he describes his ministry. He says, it was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified. That's a beautiful description, isn't it? When I came to your town, when I preached with my words, it was like putting a huge picture in front of you of Jesus on the cross. That was my message. Right? Imagine this huge poster of Jesus hanging on the cross. That's what Paul had preached. And then he says to them, let me ask you this. Did you receive the Spirit by works of the law, or by hearing with faith? And they would say, well, hearing with faith. Right? We don't earn the Spirit. We trust and we receive. Okay. All right. So why are you so foolish? He says, having begun by the Spirit, are you now being perfected by the flesh? What does that mean? Well, to put it really simply, how did they begin the Christian life? by looking to Jesus. How did they think they were growing as Christians? By looking to themselves. So simple, but that's so huge. And that's really common as well. How often have you been in a situation where somebody preaches the gospel and it's all faith, it's all Jesus, it's all great, and people come forward and they trust and they pray and they get saved, praise the Lord. And then the evangelist says, now that you've trusted Jesus, here's some things you need to do. And immediately the focus is shifted. You need to speak and read and pray and go and say, and it's all, okay, I must. And I understand why they say it. But Galatians 3:3 makes me nervous to kind of go there, you know? You've trusted Jesus. Now, let me tell you how you can keep trusting Jesus would be a far better end to that gospel presentation. You know, because you're going to be tempted to stop trusting Jesus. You're going to be tempted to stop looking to him and how wonderful he is. Let me encourage you and help you practically to keep your eyes on him. Okay, so Paul in Corinthians, Paul in Galatians, John or Jesus in John 3, Hebrews 12, another example. You remember that one? Let us, throwing off, casting aside, all of that, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, laying aside every weight, sin which clings, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Next phrase, looking to Jesus. Right, the author and perfecter of our faith, or the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising its shame, is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. How do we live the Christian life? Looking to Jesus. I think it's 1 Peter 1 verse 8. Let's go with that one. Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him, and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. So Peter's saying there, you don't see him, but he's everything to you. So it's kind of like you are looking towards him. You are captivated by him. And then what about 1 John 3, 1 John 3? See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God, and so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. So we're kind of building up this picture, right? Of how do you become a Christian in the first place? Responding to the gospel, you're trustingly looking with a loving gaze towards him. That whole thing is a gift of God, of course. How do you grow as a Christian? Looking to Jesus, right? Not turning back to your own efforts, but keeping your eyes on him. How does this journey get completed? We see him. And when we see him as he is, everything else is going to get burned away. That's worth thinking about. Why does that make such a difference? Why is it that when we see Jesus in the future, we will be like him? Because we will see the one that has captivated the Father for all of eternity. We will see the one who is life itself. Just think about all the things we've lived for and been distracted by, and all the idols and the dreams and the different things, the sort of lesser versions of Jesus, and all the sins and all the temptations and everything in this life. When we see him, it's like, oh, that's the whole deal. And it's going to just transform us. I think that's the moment at which we no longer struggle with temptation. But that's not yet. And right now, in this life, we're still in the stage of, I've trusted him, but I'm struggling. I've trusted him, but I drift. Okay, we all drift. We all feel it, right? None of you are absolutely flying high every moment of every day just on fire for Jesus. That's not human experience in this life. And so what is it that pulls us away? That's what we're really going to focus on, okay? I've kind of established the Christian life in simplistic terms, but it's biblical. Looking to Jesus, that's how we get in, it's how we get on, it's how we get done, if you want to make a three-parter, right? The beginning, the ongoing, and the culmination is all about looking to Jesus. but something pulls us away. I've written a book that I haven't published yet on this specific thing, but I talk in that book about fallen world gravity. Okay, you know what gravity is, I hope, or you may have noticed. If you climb out of that window, you will discover what gravity means, and so will the people sitting down in the lobby enjoying their ice cream when suddenly you arrive, right? Because gravity works whether you believe it or not, right? It doesn't matter if you convince yourself it doesn't apply. It applies, all right? And we all tend to be stuck to the ground most of the time. Okay, so gravity is a reality whether we believe it or not. Fallen world gravity or spiritual gravity is also real. There is something that is constantly pulling us away from looking to Jesus. Before we were Christians, it's all we knew. Now that we're Christian, it's frustrating, but it's still there. What is it that's pulling us away from him? I suppose the key thing that we've got to recognize, and this is so basic, but I just want to say it, make sure that we all understand and get it. The key thing is that Genesis 3 changed everything, right? Genesis chapter 3, in many ways, the most important chapter in the Bible because it explains every second of your life, every moment of your experience, right? In Genesis 1 and 2, what happened? I know this is after lunch, so I'm just going to help you. Creation, right? So God created everything and it was good, right? And then eventually he created female and then it was very good. And then there was a wedding and it's all wonderful, right? Everything's going well. And then chapter 3. Something shifts dangerously, massively in chapter 3. The last verse of chapter 2 says they were naked and they were not ashamed. Chapter 3 verse 8 says they were naked and then they act very ashamed. Total difference. Something shifted. What happens in chapter 3, verses 1 to 7? I suppose a simplistic way of thinking about it is that the serpent introduced a different direction to look. Is that fair enough? Before, the great commandment kind of applied, what are we supposed to live for? What is living? It's loving God and loving others. Oh, God, you're amazing. You're generous. I love fruit salad. This is awesome. All right? And also, wow, she is stunning. Good grief. What have you done, Lord? You made that out of my rib. Woo! You know, and she's excited. But we know he was because he wrote a whole poem. And so, you know, there's a kind of excitement about each other and a delight in the Lord. Loving God, loving others, that's what we're supposed to be doing. What does the serpent introduce? You can love yourself. You don't want to trust God. Did he really say that? Does God really mean this? Maybe he's holding out on you. Maybe there's a better thing. You can choose it and you can pursue it and you can explore it and you can experience it and then you can be like me. I'm on the other side and I'm okay. And this whole kind of enticing conversation takes place. And to put it really simply, what happened? They went from God and wife to me. They became self-focused, right? So ultimately, anything that's taking us away from looking at Jesus is going to have something to do with turning back on ourselves. Anything that kind of drives us inwards, be a little bit concerned. What you need is to look to Jesus. Self-focus, self-obsession, self-concern, that's a problem. Okay, so the corruption that took place in Genesis 3 is then the reality of the world, right? So let's go past Genesis 3. And at this point, don't keep reading. I'm not talking about Cain and Abel. I know what happened. But imagine two people. They could be brothers, doesn't matter. But imagine two people living in the world after Genesis 3. What do they know about God? Honestly, nothing unless he tells them. We don't have free access to God anymore. We have to figure it out. And if we figure it out, we get it wrong. Right? Is that fair enough? Okay, so they don't automatically understand God. Do they automatically understand everything else? No. Because the fall has affected everything. It's affected the plants, the animals, their bodies, their minds. Everything is not what it was supposed to be. And so I want us to think about, okay, what happens with two hypothetical brothers who live in adjacent plots of land to help us understand what happens in Christianity today, what happens in the world today, what happens in society today, because it all basically comes down to falling one way or the other. Okay, so imagine these two brothers. They both got a plot of land, okay, a certain amount of space, and their lives are basic, really simple. Get up, work, eat, interact with family, go to sleep, do it again. All right, so same lives, but they've got two different approaches to life. And from their own limited experience, they are going to start doing theology, trying to understand reality, understand God, understand self, understand what life is all about. There's only two ways, really, to live in that sense. So let's take the first brother, put him over on this side so I can try to be consistent. He has within him a sense, kind of an innate sense, that we were created for something else. To put it simplistically, I suppose, or nicely, we were created for a garden, right? The Garden of Eden. But he's not there anymore. He doesn't know why or what he's missing, but there's something he craves. But he looks at the world, in his case, his plot of land, he looks at it as a wilderness. It's like a garden with no walls. It's out of control. And so what does he do? He works. Just like his brother, he works, but he works as well as he can, and he applies his brain, and he applies his muscles and strength, and just trying to be successful at getting this thing under control. Some of us have the same experience every time we step into our backyard. It's like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm trying to get it under control. Like, that's what he was doing, right? And he discovered that if he worked hard and really got hot and sweaty, preparing the ground, he would get better crops. If he used his brain and noticed that when the donkey did, you know, and then he spread it, there was better crops. And so he starts going, okay, donkey, have, you know, eat some more food and let's mix it everywhere. And he's discovered fertilizer. So he's using his brain and he's using his muscles and he's working the thing, and it's going really well. And then eventually he kind of does what humans do, and he starts to think about God, divine things. Doesn't know anything. He thinks he knows everything. Because his little world, he's in charge. In his little world, he puts in the effort. He puts in the thinking processes. He achieves success. And that's his whole view of everything. It's all about kind of success. And so what is God like? Well, God must be that. God must be the most powerful, the all-knowing, the truly successful, right? Because what he's experienced, he just projects it upwards and says, that's what God must be like. Now, is he right in what he said so far? Is God all-knowing? Yes. Is he all-powerful? Yes. Is God successful at what he does? Sure. Where's the problem going to come? The problem's going to come in the fact that he's a fallen human. And what's a fallen human? Selfish. He's thinking that he's the center of the universe. Therefore, God must be the center of the universe. He does everything for his own glory. Therefore, God must be sucking glory in his own direction. Like, the one thing he's not going to guess about God is a selfless, humble, relational being, because he's not that. He's a selfish, proud, our relational being, even though he's married and has children. They're serving him, right? The wife is cooking for him. The children are to make him feel successful. Everything's about himself, and so he can't help but assume that God is a bigger version of that. God is me on steroids. Okay, so you've got a whole theology now starting to form, starting with a fallen human projecting upwards. And some of what he says about God is true. Some of what he says about God is backwards. But that's his theology. So let's think about that theology. I've got in the notes, so from garden to a wilderness, the dangerous drift of, quote, success. What's his view of life? His view of life is success through knowledge and power. That's what my life is about. I must be successful. I must gain knowledge and exert power. This actually isn't just a guy in a garden years ago, is it? This is everyone. What's a successful life? Getting educated, knowing enough to be successful, having power and influence, whether it's in the marketplace or in the sports team or in the discussion in the bar. I want to be the one who knows and I want to be successful, right? Even if it's just showing off to some friends about some random subject. I know more than you. Listen to this. It feels really familiar, doesn't it? Life is about knowledge and power leading to success. And if I can't be successful in sport, I'll be successful in this. And if I can't be successful in this, I'll be successful in that. And a lot of humans are spending their whole lives looking for somewhere they can thrive. And I sometimes talk about this in terms of, I think it's a male-female difference, to be honest. I don't know if this is true for women, but I know it is for men. A lot of men have a specialized subject. And it's sometimes really niche, you know? It's like the type of metals used in screwdrivers in the 1970s. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the most obscure little thing. It could be sports statistics. It could be, you know, what happened between 1917 and 1918 on the French front of the First World War. It's the movies by so-and-so. It's something, and it's there, and they're waiting. And they sometimes wait for years, every quiz, hoping there's a question about screwdriver metals. Not this time, maybe next time. And eventually, like, the moment comes where you're sat in the bar at ELF and someone makes a comment about, oh, this chair's loose, I need a screwdriver. Well, screwdrivers, did you know? And they go for it, you know, and you sit there like, what was that? But that was their moment. They've been living for it. And let's admit it, we've all got those. At least guys, I think ladies are more sophisticated. But most guys, I think, have that kind of little bit of knowledge that we're guarding because we don't want to be laughed at. We don't be mocked, but we're waiting for the moment where we can go, oh yeah, I know the answer to that. And everyone goes, wow, how did you know that? And then we act all humble, you know? That's what life is about if you view the world in the way this brother does. Okay, so what's your view of God? Well, God is me on steroids. Now, is that biblically true, that God's like a bigger version of us? Sort of. In as much as we're like him, he's like us. That's just a logical obviousness, isn't it? But there's so many ways that he's not like us. And I think this idea that if you really want to kind of make it, okay, hang on, we got a problem, is when I say God is like a bigger version of a fallen human. No. God is not the ultimate selfish, self-serving, self-honoring, self-glorifying, destroy everything in his path kind of a being. That's not what God is like. The Bible, if you've read it, points that out. Now, don't get me wrong. God is the only one worthy of glory. I'm not saying he isn't. And there is a place where God says, I'm not going to share my glory with anyone else because it would be wrong to do so. Other gods are pathetic. He's the one that's worthy of glory. But is God this grabbing, selfish God? Not at all. You look at what the Bible presents, especially with the clarity of the New Testament and the Trinity. The Father is always talking about the Son. The Son's always talking about the Father. For example, if you're into statistics, some of you sports statistic types, in the book of John, in this version in English, I haven't done it with the Greek, in the English ESV, there are 418 sentences spoken by Jesus. Okay, so you know what a sentence is. 418 of those spoken by Jesus. Guess how many of them he refers to the Father and the Son in some form? 192, 45%. Now, that's way higher than even the most obsessed person you've ever listened to talk about their football team. 45% of what Jesus says in John's gospel is about the Father and the Son in relationship with each other. That's astonishing. You see, Jesus talks about the Father. The Father honors the Son. The Spirit points you to the Son. The Trinity is selfless, gloriously, beautifully different. But any other version of God is going to be selfish, singular, monadic. There is a God who is like the God this brother's describing, who's up and separated and in charge of everything and all about his own power and knowledge and not in the slightest bit relational. What God is that? Any thoughts? A God who is totally self-focused, totally glory-grabbing, all for himself. Sorry? Allah. Yeah, so Allah in Islam, that's the description of Allah. Or if you'd have said Satan, I'd have taken that as well. The God of this age is like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. I'm hungry, I'm hungry, I'm hungry. But he's contrasted with the real God. Right? So you've got this version of God that is my ego projected upwards, my fallen selfishness. He's me on steroids. And if that's where you start your theology, your understanding of life, you're going to have issues. All right? Now, what are the implications of that view? Well, I suppose there's a few different things we could think about. We could think about society in general. The idea that society is a wilderness that needs to be organized, needs to be protected so that we can live, it's actually kind of a description of the West. Think of cowboys heading out into the wild Western frontier. It's a wilderness out there, but they're establishing law and order. So the sheriff was a big deal. You know, creating structures, creating civilization, creating democracies. It's a very Western mindset that we want to have as much government as necessary to allow you the freedom to thrive. Okay, so you want to do your business, you want to do your art, you want to do your thing, great. But we need a bit of law and a bit of protection so that you don't steal his art and he doesn't steal your car and you don't shoot his mom. So we have enough structure and order is necessary to allow people to be free and thrive. It's actually not bad. I think it's the best option we've got. That's kind of this brother's view of society. Ordered freedom. Okay, fair enough. Does it lead people to salvation? No. Just because there's a democracy doesn't make people Christians. But, you know, probably a better option than most alternatives. But what about the implications for religion? If you try to build a religion from his mindset, you get Islam. You get monotheistic type of power gods that are crushing everything for their own glory. Actually, this brother, I haven't even given him a name, but just a guy in a garden or in a field, he's actually thinking in a way that later on gets developed in a sophisticated way by someone called Aristotle. Right? Aristotle's view of reality was that you look at all the particulars and all the individual things and you organize, categorize, and make sense of it. That's Aristotle. That's who this guy really is. But if I say Aristotle, people go, ooh, that's intimidating. So a brother, you know, working his lawn, his field, that's much better. But Aristotle really is just a sophisticated version of this guy's theology. His metaphysics is what this guy believes. It's about power, it's about knowledge, it's about success. The ultimate divine it is very self-glorifying. And where does Aristotle's metaphysics get put into religious form? Islam. If you know your history, Islam is metaphysics put into action. And so there's this kind of religious tradition in the world that's very law-heavy, very intense, very powerful and knowledgeable and pressuring and controlling, and it's not attractive at all, but it's there. It exists, and it's common. It's a way that we fall. But you're thinking, I don't fall into Islam. Never once have I thought I should probably go to the mosque this week, right? Like, we don't fall into Islam, but what about Christianity? Could it be that that view of God, developed by everyone standing in their field or developed in a sophisticated way by Aristotle, is it possible that that has become part of our Christian thinking as well? Absolutely, because spiritual gravity will pull us towards it. Now, if we had time, we could go through the history, and I would suggest that the key person to look at might be Thomas Aquinas in terms of bringing Aristotle into the church. In fact, can I just be bold and say you're better off looking at Luther? Because Luther looks at that and says, ooh, that shouldn't be in here. Sometime look up Luther's 97 theses. You've heard of the 95, they went viral. Okay, they're famous. But 6 months before, he wrote 97 theses against scholastic theology. And in those 97 theses, they're just one-liners, but he's having a go at Aristotle being in the church. In one place he says, if I did not know better, I would say that Aristotle were the devil himself. He's saying in another place, why do we think that to become a theologian, you have to first study Aristotle, which was part of their education system? Luther says, I tell you what, you cannot become a theologian if you study Aristotle. He'll poison you. Luther's great. He just, you know, if you want someone just punching harder than you do, read Luther. But Luther's going after this guy's view of reality via Aristotle, via Thomas Aquinas, and in the church. What does it look like in the church? It looks like Aristotle's metaphysics with Christian language. We've got to be careful of that. The idea that God is like an ultimate selfish ego, sucking all glory to himself. And anything he does that's relational is just for our benefit, because really he's not like that. There are Christian theologians who talk in those terms. They don't tend to be open about it, but if you dig, you can find it. You go, whoa, are you sure? Because the God I'm discovering in the Bible is really loving and generous and kind. And yeah, he takes sin very seriously. Don't get me wrong. He's ready to judge, but it's a judgment born out of love. It's a jealousy for his bride or for his son's glory. It's actually beautiful. And when we look at this and we fix our eyes on Jesus, we discover a beauty in it that sometimes you get kind of sucked away by this different view of God that is in the church. A God who is all about law, all about power, all about success and control. Is it true that God is all-knowing, all-powerful? Yes. Is it true that God gives law? Yes. But is he obsessed with it? I remember reading a book some years ago, and it was talking about Calvin. It was talking about how John Calvin, it was very clear, and he's quoting great chunks of Calvin, God was firstly gracious, but then as sin entered, then it was necessary to give law to bring people to himself, right? So there's kind of a grace, then law. But then this guy was saying, but what happened? Because these guys later on who claim to be following him have reversed it. God is a lawgiver. But it's okay, because if we break the law, he can also be gracious. But it's secondary. Hang on, which is it? Before anything existed, before God created anything, when the only thing that existed was the Trinity, what was God doing? Was he sat on his throne thinking, oh, I need something to rule. I've got some great laws, now I just need some subjects. No, that's not God. John 17:24 tells us, before anything existed, the Father was glorifying the Son because he loved him. That's different, isn't it? That's the God that we talked about first, the God that captivates our hearts, that we look to. This version of God over here makes God into the pure law kind of God. It takes our theology and makes it law, 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 all the way through. And then it makes our churches heavy and hard and difficult and competitive. You ever been in a competitive church? Oh, it's horrible. You just kind of want to go away on a vacation just to breathe and get a break from the pressure of being at church. That's not the way it's supposed to be. Somehow, a wrong view of God has got into the church, and we keep falling into it, and I'll put my hands up and say, I'm guilty of it too. I easily fall into a view of God that he is all about pressure and law and rules, and it's not really genuinely loving, it's not really understanding and kind and caring and gracious and compassionate and all the things that Jesus reveals, it's just like I take the hard stuff and I lose the fullness. And everything I say is technically true, but it's an incomplete picture. God is strong. God is powerful. God is a lawgiver. Sin is lawlessness. But God is not just a lawgiver, and sin is not just lawlessness. Do you see what I'm saying? So you can have truth, but it can be thin instead of full. And as we read this, hopefully we can try to stay with a full, enriched view of God and keep our eyes on Him. Because I tell you what, when you start to think of God as being all about power and control and success, you start to think about yourself in those terms. And before you know it, your Christianity is all about you. I need to get up earlier, try harder, be more involved at church. I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to be better, I've got to be seen to be good, because otherwise how will people know? And you can get into this trap of acting like a Christian, but the inner reality is fading. Anybody ever felt that drift? Or is it just me? I tell you, it's a pull, isn't it? But that's not the whole story. So let's think about the second brother. So this first brother, keeping it nice and simple, he's working his land, he's spreading stuff, digging it, growing crops. Wonderful. It's all about success. The world is a wilderness. It's like a garden with no walls. But by my effort, I can bring success to it. Okay, his brother. Next plot of land over. Gets up. He works, finishes work, eats, interacts with the family, goes to bed. Same rhythm, but he's got a totally different view of reality. How's that possible? Maybe he looks over the fence and sees his brother sweating, bigger muscles, obviously clever, published his first book about agriculture. I mean, his brother's just annoying, right? He works, nothing happens. He tries to grow things, they die. He doesn't have anything to spread because his donkey died. Like, the whole thing is frustrating for him. And so what has he got? If he hasn't got success to be his framework for life, one thing he does have is his dreams, his longings, right? So he gets frustrated by his brother, and he's frustrated by work, actually frustrated by the wife and the children. Everything's frustrating, but sometimes he just dreams, just imagines. Wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be great if? I wish I could. Oh, if only. And those longings are fed by some things. Like his wife's cooking. Once in a while, she pulls off like a really nice goulash or whatever you're into. And he's like, oh, this is amazing. And it kind of sparks a feeling. I wish I could eat this all the time. I wish she didn't normally burn it. You know, like, and he's got this kind of longing for better food. And, you know, he's married, and so sometimes something very exciting happens. And so he's like, well, there must be something more. There must be some ultimate state. And before he knows it, he's off into some sort of theological idea of an ultimate reality where everything's wonderful. It's like the perfect experience, the perfect food, the perfect feeling. No stresses, no problems, no sweat, none of this. No work, no brother, right? No having to earn and having to make the effort, just everything, oh, just like one great experience. He's kind of taking his world and he's projecting it. Okay, so the first brother says, God is bigger me, me on steroids. He's a bigger me. This brother's saying, God, whatever that is, the ultimate being, is beyond this. It's not to be found in earthly stuff. It's not to be found in food and married life. And it's not to be found anything down here. It's got to be some kind of alternative reality. Should we call it a spiritual or a mystical reality? And he starts dreaming of something out of reach. Can you kind of see how that happens with humans? We either think, right, work hard, or we think, oh, if only. There's not really much else, to be honest. And I think this kind of works for the whole of history. Okay, so there's an ultimate reality. What is he thinking? He's made for a garden, but unlike his brother, he doesn't see the world as like a garden with no walls, a wilderness to be brought under control. He sees the world as a trap. It's like a prison. It's a garden with high walls. and he wishes he could get out of it. And so he starts longing for escape. Okay, so one of them thinks the world's a wilderness, the other one thinks the world's a prison. But God created a garden. So they've both got a mistwisted, broken view of reality. And everything that we said about this guy, we can kind of parallel with this guy. All right, so how does he view life? What is life about? It's about escape. I want to escape, right? I'm frustrated. I've got frustrated longings, but I know there must be a dream place where my longings can be satisfied. How do I get to it? Well, he's kind of stuck. And if it isn't a physical place, maybe he doesn't have to physically leave. Maybe he can just spiritually leave. And so, well, maybe everything that's down here is kind of holding me back. I'm trapped. Everything is, my mind is filled with dirt and manure and seeds and children and, oh, you know, and he just kind of takes these times just to imagine and to dream and try to separate himself from it. He's becoming a mystic, right? He wants to not be caught up with the things of this world, right? He wants to stop using his phone, right? He's becoming quite mystical in his spirituality. That was anachronistic, but you know what I'm saying. So his whole view of life is a spiritual experience, and it's up to me to try to get to it. And so he beats himself, whips his body, stops everything. You know, his brother buys a new tractor to work the land, and he says, no, 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 I shouldn't have any luxuries. I'm going to go back to just using a stick to try to plow the land. Like, he just does anything he can to make life harder or to escape it or to stop working, anything, because ultimately life is not this. I've got to escape. It's a totally different view of reality, and it leads to a different view of God. Where this guy thought of God as himself on steroids, this guy thinks of God as his longings on steroids. The things he longs for, the things he dreams about. But just like his problem was, even though there was truth in what he guessed, he was a fallen creature, so's this guy. Right? Let's step back for a second. Imagine we could time travel back to the Garden of Eden, back into Genesis 2. Adam and Eve have just met. The wedding music is still playing. Adam is on the 15th verse of his poem. And we kind of come into that, you know, sorry, we're from ELF. Oh, right. And we've arrived, all right? Imagine if we said at that moment, hi, excuse me, Mrs. Eve, you've just come to life, right? And you've just met your husband. And the fact that he's saying all this stuff about you really is quite significant. You don't understand yet, but men don't do that unless they're madly in love. So, okay, anyway. Eve, we want to talk to you about God. Oh, I haven't met him yet. Okay, well, what do you think he's like? Is she going to guess accurately? I think she'd do okay. Well, he's generous in everything that he's made. He's obviously powerful because this is stunning, and there's an intricate detail and beauty to it all, and he's obviously relational because look at us. I mean, the guy's still going on his poem, and I'm loving it. And like, there, anything that she guesses is probably going to be fairly decent theology. But after Genesis 3, we're fallen humans. What do we guess? This brother's not guessing, oh, well, I'm married, therefore God must be relational. I love my children, therefore God must love his children. He's not thinking in those terms. He's thinking, I love the feeling in my stomach when I have food. I love the feeling somewhere else when I have sex. There must be an ultimate experience that is for me. So it's still selfish. It's not relational. You see the problem? And so God is an impersonal, out-of-reach experience to be chased. So his theology is on a path. Can you think of anywhere that's going to go? Well, let's get to that in a second. What does it mean in terms of implications? If we've got this guy's view of reality, we said, well, you kind of get the Western frontier and law and order and stuff for society, but you also get religions like Islam, and actually you get stuff like Satan from the Bible, and you get it coming into the church and pulling us away from our gaze on Jesus and focusing on our own efforts and our own success. Okay, what about on this side? What's the view of society that isn't this is a wilderness, we need to organize it to allow for individual freedom. That's that guy over there in the West. What's the alternative? Society is a prison. And we don't tend to talk in societal terms about escape, but we talk about revolution. Now, oof, hello. Maybe your political mind just exploded. Like, what is that? A whole human mindset based on revolution. That's very Eastern, isn't it? Can I say communist? Is that allowed? It's about bringing in a revolution, no matter how hard it is, because ultimately the collective good for all will be worth it, even if hundreds of millions of people die in the process. But it's a goal that is collective instead of individual, right? But it's a revolutionary goal. We've got to go through the angst. We've got to go through the work. We've got to suffer in order to achieve utopia. What's utopia? It's that ideal dream that people live and die for but don't reach. How much has that happened in society? The kind of utopian dream. And it's not just East versus West, you know, Rocky IV kind of Cold War. What about what we're seeing in society today? If we will do the work, as in recycling, as in rescuing everything because there's a climate catastrophe, there's a problem, and we've got to sacrifice everything, including our jobs and our cars and our freedom to travel. If we'll give up everything, then something good can happen for a future generation. It's worth it. You suffer. It's very this guy's way of thinking, isn't it? It's a utopian dream being pushed onto people to reframe the whole of society. There's only two options. It's either power and control and oppress, or it's revolution with a whole load of oppression. In human terms, it's pretty bleak, isn't it? People get hurt, people get taken advantage of. I would rather live in that society in this life, to be honest. I don't want this one. But neither of them are the gospel. Neither of them give us ultimate life. Only Jesus does that. And we're getting pulled in our natural way of thinking into this world's a prison, or this world's a wilderness. I must work, or I must be part of the collective escape revolution. What about religion? What's a religion that might come from this guy's way of thinking? This world is a trap. I've got to separate myself from it so that I can pursue an experience that is ultimately impersonal and totally satisfying. Yeah, Buddhism, Hinduism, it's all that kind of... Yeah, see? It's sort of a mystical escapism. All right, so Buddhism is that religion developed. Remember I said that there's this very sophisticated way of writing about this guy's way of thinking, Aristotle. What's the very sophisticated way about writing about this guy's way of thinking? Aristotle and Plato. In Marx, yeah, political terms, yeah, absolutely. But in philosophical terms, it's Plato, isn't it? That everything here is not really the big deal. The big deal is in the mind of God. Everything here is just a shadow. The ultimate is beyond. You know, and so Platonic religions have come down through the centuries, Neoplatonism and so on, and they tend to be mystical, right? You've got to beat yourself. You've got to separate. You've got to stop thinking. You've got to get out of this world. You've got to stand on a pole. You've got to sit in a cave, whatever. You've got to retreat, and you've got to strive really hard in order to escape physical reality and get some experience. What's that got to do with Christianity? Has that ever got into the church? It was getting into the church in the Bible. Actually, so was the other one. What were the Pharisees? They were from over there. What's the nature of Israel in the Old Testament? A lot of that stuff. But what about this mystical escapism? Do we get that in the Bible? Yeah. What's Gnosticism? What's Colossians critiquing? What's 1 John critiquing? What's 1 Corinthians critiquing? It was already coming in. And then fast forward a few years and you get a guy called Pseudo-Dionysius. You ever heard of his name? Okay, that's the most thrilling 12 pages you will ever read. His book, smaller than my books, A Mystical Theology. Most influential book in the church for 1,000 years. And then they discovered that it wasn't Dionysius, the Areopagite, that wrote it. It was a 5th century Neoplatonist. So he's called Pseudo-Dionysius. That's kind of sad, isn't it? Oh, what book did you write? I wrote a book by fake me. Like, that's kind of weird. But Pseudo-Dionysius' book, A Mystical Theology, shaped Christianity from about 500 to 1500, 1,000 years of massive influence. And if you read it, your brain will go, what? Because it's all about how the ultimate being cannot be described because it is beyond anything that we can describe. And if we find a word that describes it, we've therefore failed because it is beyond that. And so God dwells in the hidden darkness of a bright, shining, brilliant shadow or something. And you go, that doesn't make sense. Nope. But Christians fall for it, get caught up in it. Instead of Christianity over here, which is learn and practice and be good at and obey and a real emphasis on look at yourself, look at yourself, look at yourself. Over here, it's look at yourself, but in a different way. Over here, it's I must be trying harder, I must work more to escape, I must fast longer, I must meditate longer, I must go and walk around mazes longer, whatever it takes for me to have some kind of out-of-body experience that I can then feel excited about and then not be able to describe to others, but they get caught up in it and follow me. Like, there's mystical Christianity that really is Platonism. It's like Buddhism dressed up with Bible verses, but not too many. All right, and so what we tend to find in the church is that there's a whole lot of this stuff because the universities, the education system, the publishing houses, they like to kind of control and dominate, and they just produce book after book after book. Some Christian books are awesomely good, usually in as much as they reflect this. But other Christian books use this to say something else. And it's heavy and it's oppressive and it's difficult. And if you really try to evaluate it in the simplest terms possible, you go, you know what? It's kind of making me look at me instead of looking to Jesus. That's massive in the church. This side doesn't produce many books. They don't tend to produce universities or faculties. They tend to produce mystics. And so the books you'll get on this side in Christian world will tend to be, are you finding your Christianity kind of dull, kind of plastic? Do the prayers just sound all the same? You're like, oh, yeah, they do. Well, then join us on this journey back to the greats who can tell us the wonderful things that they used to know when they were really close to God. And then you get like a parade of spiritual disciplines that you should be doing in order to experience that. Or you get a book about someone who was so saintly, it's like mind-blowing, Teresa of Avila. That kind of stuff. It's mystical. It's a bit weird. And you go, oh, what's going on? And yet it's in the church. And you see, what I'm trying to present to us is to say, look, Christianity actually is fairly simple. Look at Jesus and get to know him this much, right? Chase him, pursue him, get to know what it means to live for him and to serve him. Everything driven by this. The best thing you can do out of today's workshop is to read your Bible. Because this is gold, this is the treasure. But be aware that human nature is going to pull us towards, I must try harder, I need to perform better, or I must escape this, I need to have an experience. And anything that's pulling you too much in one of those directions, go, whoa, 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 hang on, back to this. Lord, I need to look at you. My quiet times have become about me. Lord, I want to see you as I read your word today. Kind of simple. But I think that explains a whole lot of history and reality and theology and religion and a whole lot of other stuff. And like I said, I don't want us to go out of here like guns loaded, right? I'm going to be on the lookout for mysticism that's dodgy. You know, don't do that. Just be gracious and read your Bible. You know, when someone goes a bit weird on you, be... Back to the Bible, you know. If you're in ministry, you have an opportunity to influence, give them this. Get them into this. Help them to see Jesus. Help them to enjoy him. If you find yourself in an environment where it's law and pressure and everything's like chewing sand, don't get your gun out. That's the way they would work. isn't it great how God is, get people into the Word, point people to Jesus, enjoy Him. That's what our church needs. That's what's going to guard us from drifting too far in either direction. It's true on a massive level, but it's true in your own little quiet time in the morning. I feel this every day. Some days I just wish I could get an experience. Some days I just wish, you know, I was a better performer. And actually, I need to realize God's got me and He loves me. And it's all about Him. It's not about me.